Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, August 10th, 2015. Will there be a South Sudan peace deal in Addis Ababa by the August 17th deadline? Some say it's looking increasingly unlikely.
We came here mandated. We are serious. We wish that we could have peace before 17 of this month. But as a practical situation, as we go along discussing the issues, we discovered that the gap is still wide between us and the government.
And a group of Eastern Equatoria state lawmakers defend their governor, who others say should be sacked for incompetence.
All are false allegations, and we have clarified to our leadership here, because I think all of you are witness to what is happening in Eastern Equatoria.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The peace talks for South Sudan continued over the weekend and today in Addis Ababa, but little progress has been made. Delegates for both sides still disagree on a number of issues, and some parties at the talks are saying they are doubtful that the two sides will in fact meet a deadline imposed by the mediation team. John Tanza is at the talks and has this report from Addis.
The chief negotiator for Riek Machar's SPLM in opposition group says he is not optimistic that the warring parties will sign a peace deal by August 17. That's the deadline that the lead mediators, IGAD, set several weeks ago. Taban Dengai says he fears the deadline will be missed because of unrealistic demands that the negotiators for President Kiir's government are making at the talks. But Deng says the rebel side is taking the deadline very seriously.
We came here mandated. We are serious. We wish that we could have peace before 17 of this month. But as a practical situation, as we go along discussing the issues, we discovered that the gap is still wide between us and the government.
Deng says the two sides are at loggerheads over the issue of demilitarization. The compromise deal that IGAD has put forward to try to break the impasse at the talks calls for Juba to be demilitarized during a transitional period. The SPLM in opposition, or SPLM-IO, is demanding that the whole of South Sudan should be free of weapons during the transitional period.
We particularly differed on demilitarization of Juba and all other major towns. That is a disagreement that we have registered as a major disagreement.
That's Stephen Parkwall, the spokesman for the SPLM-IO at the talks. He says the people of South Sudan have lost trust in the South Sudan army. Par says peace is only possible if a neutral force is responsible for ensuring security. South Sudan's Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs and Chairman of the Security Committee at the talks says he disagrees with the proposal to demilitarize Juba. Peter Bashir Gwendi says the mediator's proposal to bring in foreign troops to watch over the towns of South Sudan is not a good solution.
As much as we appreciate any solutions that should come from our friends in the region and international community, we would want to own the process. We would want to have self-confidence in ourselves, build the trust. I know the conflict has destroyed the confidence that existed between us, but we have experiences in the past. Like when Riek defected in 91, he went and came back. Did he have to have foreign forces to come and accompany him?
The government spokesman, Michael Makui, says he remains hopeful that the rebels will change their minds. He says the points of disagreement should not bar the way to peace.
Tomorrow we will revisit all the disagreed issues, hoping that some of us may have a change of heart or a change of mind and make concessions. In lieu of that, then the rest will have to go to the principal.
The IGAD Plus mediation is expected to provide an alternative demilitarization and present it to the warring parties tomorrow. The parties to the talks are also expected to discuss humanitarian situation in South Sudan when the talks resume tomorrow. For VOA News, I'm John Tanza reporting from Addis Ababa.
Getachew Ziru Kebrigadan is a scholar at the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Woodrow Wilson Center. He says he's cautiously optimistic that the August 17th deadline will be met, but questions whether it will actually usher in peace in South Sudan. South Sudan In Focus reporter Ian Bior spoke with Getachew about prospects for peace and the role the international community should play in the negotiations in Addis Ababa.
I believe that this new beginning should be supported by action. Of course, President Obama clearly indicated that August 17 is the deadline for the conflicting parties to agree with the proposal given by IGAD. But it has to be questioned first, the proposal itself. To what extent the proposal will be in the interest of the South Sudanese people? Are we talking about power sharing between Machar and Kiir? Or we are talking about power sharing within the context of the interests of the South Sudan? Therefore, I believe that even though the United States of America tries to put some steps into the South Sudan's problem, especially to deal with it, still I don't think so that will be sustainable in terms of resolving the problems of South Sudan unless there is concrete action.
Could you give me some examples of concrete action?
The United Nations Security Council have to discuss with the African Union Peace and Security Council, so that they have to have a hybrid force that will help to halt the human rights violations in South Sudan. Because we are not talking about simple quarrels. We are talking about the deaths of thousands of people, the deaths of children, the deaths of mothers, the deaths of innocent people. And therefore, to stop this, I think force is very important. From what we learned from the behaviors of the conflicting parties. That's what I suggest.
So you're basically saying first stop the bleeding. And what you mean by that is get the UN in to protect vulnerable communities in South Sudan.
Yeah, I'm saying that first and foremost, the two leaders of the two functions, the leaders of the government of Sudan and the leaders of the rebel groups, will not represent the people of South Sudan. And therefore, if we believe that, those people should be forced to leave office and give for the other actors who can represent the people of South Sudan.
There's a part of South Sudan who feels like they are being excluded from what's going on. So my question is, do you think that South Sudan is setting itself up for more conflicts in the future?
I believe that the existence of these two leaders who are always fighting for power sharing will not bring sustainable peace for South Sudan. That's why I question the peace process itself, which is basically focusing on power sharing between Machar and Salva, which excludes the interests of the other ethnic groups. I think South Sudan have nearly 75 ethnic groups, according to some research. And therefore, they have to be representatives, those people. And the representative of those people should be part of the peace process. To represent those people, I think the mediators should consult the leaders on the ground. There are leaders of women association, there are leaders of youth association, there are leaders of tribes, there are leaders of clans, there are leaders of religious institutions, and therefore they have to consult them. So the peace process should come from bottom to up rather than from up to bottom. That is really, if that will not happen in the future, I don't think so that sustainable peace will prevail in South Sudan. So there must be revision of the peace process itself.
That was Wilson Center scholar Getachew Ziru Gebrekadan. He spoke with South Sudan in Focus reporter Ian Bior in Washington last week. About a dozen Eastern Equatoria state politicians have rushed to Governor Louis Lebong Lahore's defense after a call went up for him to be fired for alleged corruption and incompetence. The governor's detractors have said Governor Lebong has done next to nothing to combat the mounting insecurity among the cattle-keeping communities of Toposa, Maasai, and Buya, among others. They also accuse him of incompetence but did not elaborate on those charges. Paul Napwan, the deputy speaker of Eastern Equatoria State Assembly, dismissed the charges while speaking to reporters in Juba. He was in the capital with a delegation from Torit today to discuss the charges against the governor with state and national lawmakers. Delegation member Charles Udwar says the charges against the governor are baseless. Paul Napwan, the deputy speaker of Eastern Equatoria State, dismissed those charges with speaking to reporters. He was there with that delegation. And here's what he had to say.
All are false allegations, and we have clarified to our leadership here, because I think all of you are witness to what is happening in Eastern Equatoria. And if you, we invite some of you to go and see by yourselves, you will see the level of insecurity. You can even sleep outside your house until morning, nothing will touch you. So that shows that the level of insecurity that was alleged is not true.
And Edouard says the governor's critics seem to be forgetting the progress made under Lebong's leadership since his election in 2010.
There is no state that has built county headquarters, story buildings in the whole South Sudan. We have built also about 24 Payam headquarters. Apart from that, we have built schools and primary health care centers and units. Then we are trying our level best to make sure we deliver services to the people in spite of meager resources that we are getting.
Napwan says his team of 15 legislators met with several top government officials during their week in Juba, including Vice President James Wanaiga.
We have concluded by saying that there is no need at this time for us to have any differences among ourselves. Since our country is in problem, we have a conflict going on around our country, within and outside. We have our own problem alone, fighting between SPLM and SPLM on opposition. And at the same time, we have also problems along our borders. So we don't need to continue having conflict among ourselves. Our citizens today need peace in order to live.
Napwan says the accusations and counter-accusations surrounding Lebong's leadership are eroding the mostly peaceful coexistence between communities in the state. Under the 2011 transitional constitution, President Salva Kiir may fire elected officials, including governors. President Kiir has dismissed the governors of Unity and Lake States. Jonglei State Governor John Kwang Nyon was appointed as the Minister of Defense in the 2013 cabinet reshuffle. Napwan and his team say there is no need for President Kiir to remove Lebong. Udwar denies that Governor Lebong has failed to present reports on state spending.
I have never heard one day any parliament in the Republic of South Sudan, including national parliament, a Ministry of Finance presenting expenditure report of what was allocated to each ministry. Assembly need to find out what happened with this money. That is check and balance, and that is an oversight responsibility of the parliament.
Udwar says the Torit delegation and the rival group calling for Lebong's dismissal have agreed to hold another meeting in Torit about whether the governor should stay or go. He did not specify when that meeting would take place. Philip Thonaleo prepared that report from Juba. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, officials in Sierra Leone lift some emergency restrictions regarding Ebola. We'll have that story when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Did you like math and science at school? Why or why not?
I like math and science in school because math helps me to think fast, and then mathematics makes me smart in terms of calculation. Sometimes math questions trick you and you have to think a lot before you get an answer to it. And then science teaches you about facts, what is around you.
I liked science because it was interesting, but for math, I had difficulty remembering the formulas. And sometimes, even when I remember the formulas, it gets all jumbled up inside my head.
I did because I realized I was good at it. Most people were afraid of doing math, so when they realize you're good, everybody will want to contact you to help them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. In Sierra Leone, some emergency regulations for the Ebola outbreak have been lifted. They were put in place a year ago to help stop the spread of the deadly disease. Kim Lewis has details, that is, from the capital, Freetown.
Sierra Leoneans have generally breathed a sigh of relief as President Ernest Bai Koroma announced a relaxation of the public health restrictions, which were meant to curb the spread of the deadly Ebola virus. About a year ago, the president imposed a state of emergency, which gave him extra powers to quarantine people suspected of having made contact with the virus. The president had also banned all public gatherings or meetings of people more than a dozen. Schools and colleges, nightclubs and restaurants were also closed, and markets were no longer to open on Sundays. But as the number of Ebola infections came down from 500 a week to single-digit patients nationwide, the president gradually relaxed the then-tight regulations. These were not enough for opposition politicians, who said the emergency regulations were a ploy by the ruling government to clamp down on opposition activities. Restaurant and nightclub owners were crying that they were going bankrupt. The youths were angry they were not allowed to watch English Premiership matches at video clubs, and market women were crying for longer market hours. As the state of emergency expired after its first year on the 6th August, the president on the 7th August imposed a fresh state of emergency, which may last for another year. He, however, lifted some of the Ebola restrictions, like the ban on public gatherings and meetings. Restaurants and nightclubs were now allowed to open, but to adhere to rules about temperature testing and washing of hands. The youths could now watch their Premier League matches and also involve in sporting activities. The peace and quiet which used to reign under the restrictions was now shattered, as loud music from bars and nightclubs were now heard all over. The president, however, warned that this does not mean Ebola is over and that the people should remain vigilant. It is not clear how many people will heed that advice. For most people, after sitting at home for a whole year, it was now time again to put on their dancing shoes. For VOA Africa, I'm Kelvin Lewis reporting from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
The United Nations says in a new population forecast released today that Earth will be home to more than 11 billion people by the year 2100. The UN says there will be no end to growth this century unless there are unprecedented declines in fertility in sub-Saharan Africa. The region's current population of 1.2 billion is expected to rise to 5.6 billion by the end of the century. John Wilmoth is director of the Population Division in the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the findings, which he'll present at a meeting in Seattle, Washington.
We forecast that the current world population of around 7.3 billion people will rise to around 9.7 billion by the middle of the century in 2050. And then it will continue to increase, reaching a level perhaps around 11.2 billion in 2100. But, of course, we have to say that those numbers are projections of future trends. They are likely to be relatively accurate within the next 30 or 40 years. But as we get out beyond that, there is, of course, increasing uncertainty about those results.
Was there any surprise at the figures, considering that we hear that resources are being strained and that efforts are being ramped up to provide food security?
Well, of course, there's always been a concern about whether it would be possible to increase the food supply on the planet to keep up with human population growth. Yet the history so far has been one of relative success, where the total food supply in the world has continued to increase, in fact, faster than the human population. This remains a challenge, in particular in certain regions and certain countries. It may be more difficult to kind of grow the food there that's needed for the population in that area. But on a global level, this has not been the constraint. Population has not been limited by our ability to increase the food supply further and further. And the Food and Agriculture Administration has a number of reports on this, but they certainly seem at least cautiously optimistic that it's possible to continue to expand the food supply to accommodate the increasing human population. This is maybe not the major issue with regard to our concern about human population growth. I think the concern actually lies in other areas.
Such as?
One of the great challenges is the speed of growth and the pace of change that that imposes on any country or society that's trying to incorporate its young citizens. So population growth at a rate of 2 or 3% per year means that every year there are 2 or 3% more babies than there were the year before. And every cohort of school children also is larger by 2 or 3% than it was the year before. And that means at a 2% growth rate that everything is doubling every 35 years. You have to double the size of the healthcare facilities and double the school system. And that's certainly possible, but we're talking about rapid population growth occurring usually, in most cases, in some of the poorest countries of the world, those that are faced with already the greatest development challenges. The need is just to upgrade the quality of the current systems for the current populations, and you add on to that the challenge of an ever-increasing population whose needs need to be addressed. The increase of quality is always challenged by the relentless increase of quantity as well.
Now, you say that the primary driver of global population growth is a projected increase in the population of Africa. Can you tell us what you expect to happen on the continent?
It accounts for more than 50% of the growth of the world population over this time period. It currently has a fertility level on average across the continent of 4.7 children per woman. We project that that will continue to decline over future decades. But the question is, at what pace? And if that pace can be accelerated by government policies that enable people to control the size of their families, that's probably a good thing, both in terms of helping people to achieve their ends, but also to slow the growth of the world's population and limit some of the challenges that it presents.
Is there a particular part of the world that will be most populous in your view?
Well, Asia will continue to be the most populous part of the world. India and China will continue to be the two largest countries, although they will change the order, and India will become the largest country in the world probably within 10 years. We're projecting now in 2022 that that will happen, so almost certainly within 10 years. But Africa will grow and become a larger percentage of the total global population, that's clear. The only major area of the world that we project will decline in size over the period from now till 2050 is Europe. Some countries are decreasing already in size. Some others have more deaths than births, but that means they would be decreasing in size except for the fact that they're receiving relatively large numbers of immigrants. A country like Germany is an example of that. It's growing slightly thanks to immigration, despite a very low birth rate.
What about the U.S.?
The U.S. has a more stable, moderate demographic profile compared to Europe on the one hand or compared to Africa and Asia and countries on the other. It maintains a fertility level that's close to the replacement level, slightly under. It's not quite enough to maintain the population in the long run without some level of immigration, but it maintains a level of immigration that allows it to maintain a kind of slow and stable growth rate.
Today is World Lion Day. This year, the celebration of the King of the Beasts has somber overtones, especially after Zimbabwe's beloved Cecil the Lion was killed by an American hunter. But animal rights activists say many lions all over southern Africa are living in cruel conditions in tourist-friendly parks. VOA's Anita Powell brings us this report from Johannesburg.
The slaying of Cecil, a Zimbabwean lion, sparked outrage and debate around the world. He was killed in July by an American hunter on vacation in Zimbabwe. Until his death, 13-year-old Cecil roamed free in Zimbabwe's Wange National Park, running a pride and fathering 8 cubs. But that sort of life is not the norm in neighboring South Africa, says London-based advocacy group World Animal Protection. 2/3 of the country's lions, about 5,800 of them, live in captivity. The group's wildlife director, Kate Newstead, says the captive lions' lives are miserable. The organization says it has documented cruel practices at some facilities. Cubs are taken away from their mothers early and are typically punished using pain and fear to curb aggression. They are often kept in small enclosures and poorly fed, and the constant human interaction stresses them. Newstead spoke to VOA News via Skype from London.
It's the thin edge of a wedge of a very, very brutal industry. It's a big business around not only the hunting of lions, but also the breeding of them, keeping them in captivity, being used in tourism. The lion parks where the cubs are petted and handled, they've doubled in size over the last 10 years. And it's also believed that these lions are being used in what are called canned hunts that are being taken out to the wild after they've had a terrible life of abuse, being shot in the way that Cecil was.
But an official at one of Johannesburg's largest lion parks, the SA Lion Park, says not all facilities are guilty. Assistant Operations Manager Scott Simpson denies his organization sells its lions for hunting and says the park keeps meticulous records open to scrutiny. He says the facility treats its 48 lions humanely, but says he cannot speak for other lion parks.
I think that argument can be made for any organization that keeps animals in captivity, zoos, sanctuaries, lion parks. When it's done properly, the animals, really, they're under no duress, they're incredibly healthy, they're well looked after, we get audited regularly. So no, I think it's done properly. The animals are under no distress at all.
But World Animal Protection says tour operators should discourage lion parks. Tourists should avoid them, and governments should crack down on them. Neustadt says tourists have a powerful role to play.
We're looking to build a global movement because we've seen that so many people have been moved by what's happened to Cecil. And we know at World Animal Protection that most people actually love animals and would never take part in any of these activities if they knew about the cruelties that are happening behind the scenes.
World Lion Day is a chance to assess the general plight of lions. According to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the African lion population has fallen 42% in just 2 decades. Cecil's lifestyle, that of a majestic beast freely roaming the African plains, is becoming a thing of the past. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Here's a recap of our top stories today. The South Sudan peace talks continued over the weekend and today in Addis Ababa, but little progress was reported. Delegates for both sides disagree on a number of issues, and some parties at the talks are saying they're skeptical that two sides will even meet a deadline imposed by the mediation team. About a dozen Eastern Equatoria state politicians are defending Governor Louis Lebong Lahoor after he faced charges of incompetence and corruption. Other lawmakers are asking for him to be fired. The governor's detractors have said Governor Lebong has done very little to combat the mounting insecurity among cattle-keeping communities as well. Paul Napoan, the deputy speaker of Eastern Equatoria's Assembly, dismissed the charges while speaking to reporters in Juba today. And finally, the United Nations says in a new population forecast that Earth will be home to more than 11 billion people by the year 2100. The UN says there will be no end to growth in this century unless there are big declines in fertility in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's a look at today's top stories. And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Goo by Magic System. We've been listening to Magic System with the song Goo. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington. On behalf of all of us here at South Sudan in Focus, thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America.